The power of the Antichrist is derived. It's not his own. Where does that power come from? Well, Satan is described as the one giving Antichrist his power and his authority. But John is saying that God ultimately gives power and authority to Antichrist.
Welcome to The Word Unleashed with Tom Pennington. Tom is pastor teacher at Countryside Bible Church in Southlake, Texas. Hello, I'm Bill Wright, and today we continue Tom's series titled Antichrist. In the book of Revelation, the Apostle John describes how Satan will raise up and empower a profoundly evil human ruler known as Antichrist. Next to Jesus Christ, this will be the most famous person in the history of the world, and he will have a profound effect on many. But is such a powerful person outside the sovereign control of God? As Tom will teach on today's program, we as Christians must understand the relationship between God's eternal decree and man's persistent and relentless sin. Friend, understanding these realities will help us see God's purposes with this truly evil person. Tom Pennington returns to Revelation chapter 13 right now, here on The Word Unleashed.
Well, I am currently rereading a historical book on World War II. I enjoy reading from that era. And I'm reading a book written by Eric Larson. It's the second time I've read it through because I found it compellingly interesting. It's not fiction, but it reads like fiction. It's basically firsthand accounts. There's not a word of fiction in it, but it's entitled The Splendid and the Vile. It's a book about Winston Churchill, the Splendid, as he battles his nemesis, Adolf Hitler, the Vile. And it's true. Read anything about history at all, and you know that Adolf Hitler was truly a wicked, evil, vile man. But amazingly, he's not the worst. He's not the vilest world ruler that there is. One day, a world ruler will arise who will be the embodiment of evil. He will be completely controlled by Satan. He will dominate politics worldwide, and he will invite, demand, and receive the worship of the whole world. We're studying the 13th chapter of Revelation, where we meet this man and we learn about his evil empire. Let's read again together the first 10 verses of Revelation 13, which describe this man. The dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshiped the dragon because he gave authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? And who is able to wage war with him?" There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies. And authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. Last time we discovered the basic theme of these verses is this: during the future 7-year tribulation that follows the rapture of the church, Satan will raise up and empower a profoundly evil human ruler as a false Messiah who will rule and receive the worship of the entire world. Next to Jesus Christ, this will be the most famous person in history. He is the Antichrist, a powerful political world ruler who will arise during the coming tribulation. In Revelation 13 to chapter 20, this person plays a crucial role. But here in chapter 13, John begins to introduce us to him and gives us two primary descriptions of this future world ruler. In verses 1 to 4, we learn about his person, and in verses 5 through 10, his career. Now, last time, we looked at the person of the Antichrist in the first 4 verses. We learned in these verses 5 important facts about this future ruler and his person. First of all, his meteoric rise. Verse 1 tells us or describes in pictorial form that he will rise from obscurity to sudden fame. He will come into the world stage with a flourish. We learned of his political power in the second half of verse 1. Antichrist will be a powerful political leader whose final world empire will be a new manifestation of the Roman Empire, as Daniel makes it clear. It will start as a 10-nation European confederacy, but it will spread to encompass the entire planet. Thirdly, we learned last time about his beastly character. Antichrist is a blending of and shares characteristics with all of the beastly rulers throughout history that have stood against God and his purpose, and those are detailed in those verses. Fourthly, we learned about his supernatural patron. He is backed by, empowered by the dragon. Verse 2 says, the dragon, in context here, that's Satan, gave him his power and his throne and great authority. And then fifthly, we looked at his counterfeit death and resurrection in verses 3 and 4. To imitate the real Messiah, Jesus Christ, and to strengthen his grip on the world, this false Messiah will experience an apparent death and resurrection. Look at verse 3. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. Later in the chapter, it's clear we're talking about the Antichrist himself. Under satanic deception, the entire planet will be convinced that this charismatic world ruler has actually died and been raised from the dead. His followers respond to that by following him as his disciple, the language is in verse 3. They will worship Satan, either in some cases knowingly, in other cases unwittingly, as they worship Antichrist himself. That's what we learned last time about the person of the Antichrist. Now today, we come to John's second primary description of this future ruler, and that is his career. The career of Antichrist is unfolded for us in verses 5 through 10. His career will be steeped in both world politics and religion. But before we get to Antichrist's specific activities, John first wants to remind us that even Antichrist is under God's sovereign control. So the first thing we learn in these verses about the career of Antichrist is that he will ultimately be governed by God. 4 times in 2 verses, John makes this point in unmistakable terms. In verse 5 and again in verse 7, John uses 4 times the passive verb was given, was given, was given, was given. You see, the power of the Antichrist is derived. It's not his own. Where does that power come from? Well, in an immediate sense, it comes from Satan. In verses 2 and 4, Satan is described as the one giving Antichrist his power and his authority. But the 4 times that John uses was given in verses 5 and 7, he's not referring to Satan. How do I know that? because John uses this exact same expression throughout his book to refer to God. It's a divine passive. John is saying that God ultimately gives power and authority to Antichrist. God is sovereign over and in complete control of the activities of Antichrist. Now, we're going to examine these verses in more detail in a moment, but for now, I just want you to notice what John says God is sovereign over when it comes to the activities of Antichrist. First of all, we learn that God decides to allow him to live and prosper in spite of his blasphemies. Look at verse 5. There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies. Secondly, we learn that God decides to allow him unopposed rule for 42 months. Verse 5 goes on to say, an authority to act for 42 months was given to him. God establishes a strict limit on the time of his reign of terror. Thirdly, God decides to allow him to successfully persecute the saints. Verse 7 says, it was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And then finally, in verse 7, God decides to allow him political control of the whole world. Verse 7 ends, an authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. Now, this passage is fascinating because of what it exposes us to. Obviously, Antichrist is making decisions. He is a real man. He's not an automaton. He's making decisions about what he wants to do, about his own strategies. At the same time, he is led and directed by Satan. And at the same time, God is overruling and directing the activities of them both and all of those under them. This is what theologians describe as the eternal decree, is what we're really talking about here. What is the eternal decree? Here's how the Westminster Confession puts it. God, from all eternity, did by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. Now look at that sentence again. From all eternity, these were decisions God made, or more technically correct, this was a decision God made in eternity past. By the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely. There were no compelling factors. God made these decisions freely and unchangeably. He ordained whatsoever comes to pass without exception. And then it goes on, yet so as thereby neither is God the author of sin, nor is violence offered to the will of the creatures, nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established. In other words, it's saying God is acting, but people are acting as well. Satan is acting. The man of sin is acting. And God is acting and directing all of that for his own purpose. Theologians divide God's decree into two classes of events. There are those that are directive. That is, God determined to effect certain events, either through necessary causes or his own actions. Of these things, we can legitimately say that God authors them and directly brings them about. God does them. But there are also events that are permissive. That is, God determined to allow created free agents to effect certain events. You know, the crucifixion of Christ is a great example of that. In Acts 2:23, we read this, this man delivered over, listen to this, by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, there's God acting, you nailed to a cross by the sins of godless men and put him to death. There's the people who crucified Christ acting. Both are true. Now, what is the relationship between God's eternal decree and man's sin? As we look at Antichrist, for example, what's the relationship between God and man's sin? First of all, God does not act on or in our wills to cause us to sin. In other words, God will accomplish his purpose, but he doesn't tempt anyone to sin, James 1 says. and he can't be tempted. He doesn't tempt anyone to sin. Enns writes this, "Man's sinful acts do not frustrate the eternal plan of God, but neither is God the author of them. All acts, including sinful acts, conform to the eternal plan of God, but he is not directly the author of all acts." God takes no responsibility for sinful acts at all. Secondly, we can say that man's sin is not simply passively permitted out of God's control and separate from his plan. No, God weaves it into his plan. Thirdly, God's decree renders every sinful act absolutely certain. We're reading about the sinful acts of a future man in Revelation 13, and it's going to happen exactly as God said. So how does that work? And here's the key. God simply determined, A, not to hinder the sinful choices of the sinner's will. In other words, he's going to let Antichrist do what Antichrist wants, and this is key, B, to direct and control the results of the sinner's choices to accomplish his own divine purposes. This is exactly how it will work with Antichrist's sinful activity. God has decreed to permit it. He controls it, ensuring that what happens is within his plan, and he directs the results for his own purposes. God will control it all, and Satan will control the Antichrist, yet Antichrist will also freely choose of his own will to blaspheme God, to exalt himself as God, and those who join Antichrist's army will do so voluntarily, but in so doing, they will fulfill God's eternal plan, his eternal decree. And the believers that the Antichrist will martyr will still be under God's protection and care. That will be his plan for them. The saints in that time can be encouraged to know that their suffering and its duration has been determined by God. Antichrist's power is limited. So, Antichrist will ultimately be governed by God. However, as we just saw, at the same time, secondly, he will be personally dominated by sin. He will be personally dominated by sin. In 2 Thessalonians 2, Paul calls him the man of lawlessness. Not surprisingly, his career will be marked by four sinful, lawless activities. So let's look at them together. Here's how he is dominated by sin. First of all, by arrogant blasphemy in verses 5 and 6. Look at verse 5. "There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words." The other book that has the most to say about Antichrist is the book of Daniel. And in Daniel 7:8, he's pictured there as a little horn. And the little horn there is described as uttering great boasts. What are these boasts? Well, John goes on to explain the nature of Antichrist's boasts and blasphemies. You remember back in verse 1, we read that on his heads were blasphemous names. Daniel 7:25 says he will speak out against the Most High. Daniel 11:36, "This king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods." When Antichrist comes to power, there will be no subtlety. His attacks on God will be public, they will be outrageous, they will be monstrous. John MacArthur writes, "Antichrist's arrogance will surpass that of anyone else in human history. He will be Satan's mouthpiece, voicing his master's frustrated rage against God. He will be the supreme blasphemer in a world filled with blasphemers." Verse 5 goes on to say, "An authority to act for 42 months was given to him." This is the same time frame, by the way, that's spelled out for Antichrist's reign of terror in other places, but in different terms. For example, in Revelation 12:14, it's called a time and times and half a time, reflecting Daniel chapter 7, meaning 3.5 years. It's the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, or it's 1,260 days, as it's described in Revelation 11:3 and Revelation 12:6. It is the second half of Daniel's 70th week in Daniel 9, verse 24. So we're talking about what transpires during the second half of the tribulation, from the midpoint through the end of the 7 years. Now, in verse 6, we discover the specific targets of his blasphemy. First of all, he will blaspheme God himself. Verse 6 says, and he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name. To blaspheme God's name is simply to blaspheme all that God is. How will Antichrist do this? He'll do it in two ways. His blasphemy will be obviously what he says against the true God, and his blasphemy will be that he will take the titles for God to himself. He will blaspheme God. Secondly, he will blaspheme God's people. Verse 6 says, and he will blaspheme his tabernacle, God's dwelling. But then he says this, and this is an interesting expression, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Now that expression, those who dwell in heaven, back in chapter 12, verse 12, referred to the saints in heaven. So what he's saying here in this unusual expression is that God's people are the place God dwells. It's a very interesting thought. It's not the only place in the New Testament, though. In Ephesians chapter 2, verse 22, it refers to believers and says, you are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit. Believers are like a temple where God dwells. Individual churches are called that in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, but all believers together are like God's temple, his tabernacle. Antichrist, notice, will blaspheme those who dwell in heaven, the saints. So he'll not only blaspheme God, but the saints in heaven. But Antichrist is not going to be just all talk. He's also going to engage not only in arrogant blasphemy, but secondly, in violent persecution. Verse 7, it was also given to him to make war with the saints. For his own purposes, God is going to allow Antichrist to make war with the saints. He's borrowing really the almost exact expression from Daniel chapter 7, verse 21, where it says, I kept looking, and that horn, talking about the Antichrist, was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. At the midpoint of the seven-year tribulation, as we've learned already, Antichrist will break his covenant with Israel. Peace will flee. Antichrist will break his covenant. He'll set up an image of himself in the temple in Jerusalem. That's the abomination of desolation. And he will demand that he be worshipped. From that point, through the rest of the 7 years, he will initiate an unrelenting wave after unrelenting wave of the violent persecution of God's people. He'll be prompted by Satan. Remember, Satan was a murderer from the beginning. And he'll be prompted to walk in his footsteps. And because of his own evil heart and his hatred of the good, like Cain toward Abel, he will hate believers. In addition, Antichrist will undoubtedly see believers as a threat to his rule, since they refuse to bow, they refuse to worship, they refuse to support his evil regime. He will see them in the same way that Nebuchadnezzar saw the three Hebrew children, leash out fury against them. Verse 7 says, and he will overcome them, not spiritually, but physically. In other words, he will kill them. Under Antichrist, in the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, there will be a worldwide slaughter of believers in the true God. We've already met some of these people in chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, in chapter 7, verses 9 through 17, and in other places. But here's the amazing thing. Even Antichrist's deadly persecution of believers is under God's control. Notice how it's put in verse 7. It was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Daniel 7:25 puts it this way. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. God himself will permit it. But he will limit its duration, and he will direct it to purposes completely unintended by Satan. He will use it to usher his saints into his presence and ultimately to defeat Satan by their faithfulness to Christ, even in death.
That's Tom Pennington here on The Word Unleashed with part 3 of his series titled Antichrist. Tom will have part 4 for you on our next program, and we hope you'll join us then. Why did God the Father send Jesus on a rescue mission to save sinners? In his book, All the World's a Stage, Tom Pennington explains from Ephesians 2:7 how God determined to save sinners through Christ Jesus for his own glory. Tom will help you understand that man is not the center of the universe, but God's glory alone is. Purchase your copy of All the World's a Stage today at thewordunleashed.org. And remember to connect with us on social at The Word Unleashed. The Word Unleashed is made possible because of the prayers and financial gifts of individuals like you. Please consider partnering with us. You can find out how to do so by visiting us online at The Word Unleashed. And now for Tom Pennington and the entire team, I'm Bill Wright. Thanks for listening to The Word Unleashed, exalting God's glory, explaining God's truth.